Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, February 2nd, 2017. And tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking more about our moon with certain recent discoveries, some of them not recent, but recently announced. It's always interesting to see how they sit on data for a while before they actually release it. And then, of course, explain that they don't know. But these were NASA studies showing that there is oxygen coming into the moon in bursts. And that's very interesting because, first of all, they don't know why. And so, but I'll explain why. And they assume that it's coming from Earth, which is interesting because to them, that would be the only possible source of oxygen in the vicinity of the moon. So anyway, I'll talk more about that. That's the main science topic. First of all, the NASCA lines paper, the part two, you have to have part one to read it. So anyway, I'll put a button up for you people to purchase. A lot of people got, as I recall, they got part one as part of a purchase. I believe I was giving that away free because it's rather esoteric topic. Not everybody on the planet's interested in the NASCA line, so it's not going to be a New York Times bestseller. So, but I am putting a button up, and it's going to be $10. And remember, it's very short. It's the actual content is a few pages and then a lot of photos. And so it's more of a contribution to offset the cost of all of my expenses that occurred when I did the studies on the NASCA lines. So just a way for me to recuperate a little bit of the cost. So I'll put a button up, and that'll be available on the webpage so you can purchase it. The way I had it set up last week is you had to either purchase the original one, which a lot of people already have, or buy a certain amount of water filter products, which maybe you don't want to purchase water filter products. You just want the NASCA lines paper. So anyway, the part two, that is. And so still, if you buy the part one, you'll get part two free. If you purchase, if you already have part one, then here's part two also. And so I'll put that button up on the page so that you can purchase the NASCA lines part two separately. And before I forget it, a very special series of information coming up here. I promised before, it may have been before Christmas, that I'm going to do a Cosmos series. Now, this is the Jim McCanny Cosmos series, but this was my intent all along. We had the Cosmos series in around the year, was it 1979? I don't know when it actually aired, but when I was at Cornell University between 1979 and 81 as a faculty member, Carl Sagan, who was the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy, which is a prestigious chair at Cornell, and they have those to draw students because students think, ooh, you know, very nice, you know, and a lot of students there, their claim to fame in their 4 years of going to Cornell was that they took an astronomy course from Carl Sagan. And so that was a big draw. You know, you paid $60,000 a year for tuition. And that was in 1979, 80, 81. And so that you could have an astronomy course for Carl Sagan and have that as a kudo. But at any rate, he was not there very much when I was at Cornell, even though he was in the astronomy space science department. He was also in NASA. A lot of the professors there I don't know the exact contractual relationship, but they actually worked for NASA. They were housed at Cornell. They were, I believe, paid under Cornell, you know, faculty. They did not teach, or maybe they taught a specialty course or something like that, but primarily they were there to do research. And so Cornell was a NASA center had all the data that came in from NASA, and that's why it was a unique place for me to be. But back to Carl, he wasn't there too much. He was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series during the time when I was at Cornell, just that two-year period. And I understand there were 13 episodes. And so what I'm going to do, and now there's the new Cosmos series with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and called Space-Time Odyssey, Cosmos, and it's produced by Ann Druyan, who was Carl Sagan's second wife. She did and produced and worked with Carl on the first series, and they produced a very large book in which they actually make brief mention of Velikovsky. And Sagan makes a very kind of coy statement there about the openness of science, and it's very strange because typically he slammed Velikovsky, but he may have been looking at a day when Velikovsky was vindicated. And so it was strange the way he kind of twisted that. And instead of absolutely slamming Velikovsky as pseudoscience, he talked about science changing and adapting. Could it have the seeds been planted in Carl's mind at that time that he could be wrong in history, and that was his way, that was his way out. That was his soft shoe stage left, exit stage left, as they say in the in vaudeville. That was what they said when they the act was not working and the crowd was throwing lettuce and tomatoes at them. That's what they did, or that's what they said. So anyway, back to the Cosmos series, Ann Druyan was Carl Sagan's secretary, who was very adept at writing and producing and rather a natural. And so anyway, they ended up getting married. And I really didn't meet Carl when I was there. He's kind of a, you know, was an obscure guy. But he wasn't there when I was there. The rest of the NASA guys were there and some other independent scientists. In fact, the last of the independent scientists, there were some at Cornell, very good scientists, very conscientious, but started complaining. And I heard the complaints that they couldn't get data. They were being blocked from getting data by the NASA monopoly. And, of course, at the end of my time there, before that, the data was very open. You could go into the rooms with the photos and all of the data. And every day after class, at the end of the day, there would be three or four sessions sometimes of data where the NASA scientists would be discussing Voyager data or Pioneer data or data coming in from Venus or other solar data that was going on. All kinds of things were going on there. So I was able to go, and I took part in these and went there and observed and was able to, I had my own theoretical work, which I already had well underway when I got to Cornell in 79 in the physics department. And so when I started seeing this data, I said, wow, this is exactly what I've been working on. The celestial mechanics, the mechanics, mathematics of how the stars and the planets and the moons revolve around each other, etc., the orbital dynamics, mechanics. And then I included electric and magnetic fields just for kicks, just to see how they would work. And I discovered many of the nuances of plasma physics in doing that. Something totally, totally remote from anything anybody was even dreaming about back then. And they saw this data coming in, and most of it they just left unpublished because they didn't know what it meant. Or they changed it, a lot of it they just left out. But I was there to see the data, and that was the basis for my creating the plasma discharge comet model, which is what I named at the time. And the understanding of how the solar wind worked. I had to understand where the electrical fields came from so that the objects, the rocks or the whatever they were coming in, would discharge that. I had to discover that there was an excess current of protons in the solar wind and that Jupiter and Saturn were small stars, not planets. So on and on, all the things that you read about in my books, which were written for the general public, starting around the year 2000 is when I started to produce the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn connection, and, you know, all the rest in the series. But before that, in the 90s, I had been doing radio shows with Art Bell back in the Hale Bopp days. I was on Art Bell's show talking about Hale Bopp. And going back into the 80s, I was attending the American Geophysical Union meetings. I had invited talks in the mid-80s at Los Alamos National Laboratory. All the scientists in NASA and Goddard and JPL knew me personally. You know, and they were kind of like stunned because they didn't really know what to make of this. Here's a guy that's independent telling them that everything they're doing is incorrect, and here's the real things that are going on. And here we are in the year 2017, and it's still the same way. I can't even believe this. I mean, they have not progressed at all. So anyway, that is going to be so the point of this Cosmos series that I'm doing, I'm going to take the content of the Cosmos series, the old Carl Sagan one and the new DeGrasse Tyson one, and use those as a platform then to show you what Standard Science is doing and still saying, they're still basically saying the same thing, you know, decades later, and then give you the takeoff of my work showing you how the universe and the solar system and planets and moons and comets and asteroids, etc., do work. And so it's really a good basis for comparison because they chose those topics to talk about. Also involved in this is my textbook study. Now, if you look on my DVDs that are on my webpage, there's the DVD 1 and 2 that are 8 remasters. There are 7 or 8, I forget, remastered videos, VHS, the old style VHS videos of me. And you can see me as a young guy back in the 80s and moving forward into the 1990s and early 2000s. So these are remastered DVDs of the old VHS tapes, and they were remastered. They did a beautiful job where I had these done. And on there is the remastering of a video that was professionally shot and recorded in 1991 when I was teaching astronomy at the university level at a state university in, it's all described there, but I was teaching astronomy at the university level. And many of you know this story. I was that fall, all of the book salesmen of all of the different companies came in, and for some reason they had all revamped their astronomy books. So this was the newest, latest, greatest astronomy for university textbooks, and they had workbooks and everything else. And so they asked me if I wanted a sample copy, of course, so that I could buy the, you know, recommend this course to my class, use it for my class, of which I had a lot of students. I had various classes. One had 90 students in it, and another had 30 in it. And so I had a lot of students, so they were set to make a pretty good sale if I chose their textbook. And so anyway, I decided, I said, you know, why don't I just get all of these? I have, you know, they're offering them to me. I'll instead of just choosing one or two and then selecting, I'll get all of them. So I did. And so I looked through these and I thought, man, I've got a resource here. This is a valuable historical resource because this is the okayed rubber stamp approved information on astronomy that would be taught to college level students in that year, 1991. So I took them all, and then I took my students and I put them into groups, and I gave each group a topic like Venus or comets or galaxies or whatever. And I said, okay, now go through all the books. So we had all the books available for the class, and they would go through all of these textbooks. And if their topic was Venus, they would look up all of the references to Venus in that book and then compile the information into tables, which I gave them a standardized table to record all of this in. And so they did this, and then they handed it all in. And then they also were to write like an essay, which all of this, I still have all of the files on this. And their job was to write an essay and also look for other, any nuances in the book. And what we noticed was that one textbook would be authored by a group of maybe one or two or three, you know, prominent astronomers. And they were typically written for various levels. So there'd be the beginner for the no mathematics astronomy people just taking it as a science requirement. Then there was the more advanced, and then there were some that concentrated on just astrophysics, you know, for people who might go on to become professionals. And then there were some that had more mathematics at all these different levels. But at any rate, what they came up with, the students came up with, was that the authors of one book were the referees and editors of another book. So this was like a big clubhouse to make sure that everybody was on the same page in this astronomy community. So the textbooks didn't conflict, or you didn't get one story over here and a conflicting story over there. And so that there was some kind of homogenization going on with these textbooks. So then I had the school actually had money for grant money for teachers to produce videos and that. They had gotten federal grant money. So I applied and I got the grant. And Hans, this professional photographer, cinematographer from, I think he was from Norway. He had an accent, a very thick accent. But Hans shot the video of me. And he mixed in, and this was when video editing was video editing. You stopped the frame with the, and he did it mastered on this very large scale VHS tape. It was a different name, I forget, but anyway, it's a different format than your regular VHS tape. Very high quality. And he edited this, did a beautiful job. We had a voice over professional read my script that I wrote into it, etc. It was very beautifully done. And you can see that. It's in, I don't remember, the two DVD set is sold as a two DVD set. And the reason I'm telling you all this is to give you a background for the Cosmos series that I'm doing, because there that resulted in a textbook study. It's called Astronomy for the 90s. Because it was done in 1991. That's when we shot this and did all of this. And so that DVD remastered from the VHS tapes is on that two DVD set that's available on my webpage. A lot of you may have that. You may want to go look at that. And so that now we have available all of the textbooks that are available today. And I have people that are helping me out, and we're doing this same study, but today. And so my Cosmos series will also incorporate all of this. So this is a really, really good background, because things don't get into textbooks unless they're well accepted in the astronomy, astrophysics, space science community. So the point of this is to use that as a basis. The textbooks, the Cosmos series of deGrasse Tyson, and then the Cosmos series of Carl Sagan, and then the, of course, the textbook study that's already been done, the 1991 study, Astronomy for the 90s, and the video, etc., was the end result of that. So, this gives me a platform, and here's the what I'm going to do. I'm putting this in, and since I'm really, really, really busy with a lot of things going on right now, I'm putting this into my paid cast. And so I'm going to have probably 13, probably 15 total episodes in the paid cast. So if you're in the paid cast, you're going to get this. And it'll be spread out over a period of time. And then I'm going to take just those out of the paid cast series, and I'm going to package them into the James McCanney Cosmos series, and people can buy that individually if they want. But if you're in the paid cast, you're going to get these anyway. So it's another way for me to promote my paid cast, and you get these at a very inexpensive price. When it's all done, it's going to cost a lot more than what you would have paid if you were in the paid cast series. So I encourage people to join the paid cast. And this is starting tonight, February 2nd, will be the first in the series of the Cosmos series. And so it'll continue on. And I'll, like I say, I'll probably have more sessions at the end to kind of wrap things up. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to base my discussion off of content in the Cosmos series. Okay, so this is kind of a long-winded explanation, but I encourage people, if you're not a member of the paid cast, and that's a good venue for me to do this in, because the other great thing is I don't have to produce visuals because they've already done that for me. And so I can leverage off what was done in the Cosmos series of Sagan, of deGrasse Tyson, to leverage off their wonderful multi-million, mega-million dollar productions. And then, of course, they're copyrighted, so I can't use those. I can use little pieces of them. But the idea is that you may want to go watch those and then listen to what I have to say afterwards. So you'll get the baloney, the tier two science that's being pawned off on you, the public, and then you'll get the real story. So it's a great comparison. So this is going to take some time for people, but given any given week, it'll take you a couple hours per week as long as you follow the series. And so anyway, starting tonight, February 2nd, I will be starting the Cosmos series, not Carl Sagan, not deGrasse Tyson, but the James McCanney Cosmos series. And so anyway, I'm very happy that's beginning. And yeah, it's the only way for me to do this is to work it into the paid cast. So go to the top of my webpage, the jmccscia.com webpage, and right at the top is the link where you can go and sign up for the paid cast. It's $3.95 a month, which is less than a cup of coffee. And you get every week paid casts. And by the way, I want to remind you that the January 19th paid cast was dealing with the election results. And it's a very, very important paid cast because I go into the 11 ways that they used to cheat. And I discuss the actual election results, showing you the 10 cheating centers that the Clintons had in the United States and gave her 12 to 17 million more votes. And I have to say something. I usually don't like to slam other talk show hosts on the air. But last Saturday, Alex Jones came up with the idea that, wow, there's big time cheating in the election, that he was going to have it studied and all of this. And the reason I'm saying this, I really liked what Alex did for the election, for Trump. He was out there on the forefront. He was very emotional, personally involved. But also, he's a little bit of criticism. When other people have done major studies on this, he has to do his research and find out what other people have done if he's going to jump into this arena. And if he does not do that, he risks losing credibility and also risks jumping off in trying to promote different tangents. But what he was trying to promote was that the illegal aliens swung the election for Hillary Clinton. And that's a small piece of that, because it wasn't only illegal aliens voting. There were a lot of illegal aliens who voted many times, as many as 20 times, as they drove them around in buses. So there was that segment. But even all of that was only one of the 11 ways they used to cheat. A little bit of criticism there. And I hope Alex picks up my study, which is a very complete study, and it invites me on the show. And if you have a call in or something like that, contact with Alex, tell him, hey, McCanney did this long study. I presented it on Joyce Riley's show as the election was going on. And before the election went on, my November 3rd radio show, this regular commercial-free show, I did an analysis of the 10 top ways to cheat to win the election, and these were historical ways that had been used in the past. I added an 11th way that we discovered during the Jill Stein recount, where the precincts were simply recording false numbers, as much as 100% increase for Hillary Clinton. And all the cheating was on Hillary Clinton's side. And with 12 to 17 million extra votes, she still couldn't win. That's why she was just aghast, and everybody else was aghast when she lost. Because, in fact, I was surprised. I thought they were going to swing it at the last minute and she would win. I really thought that. When the announcement didn't come till 2 in the morning, I thought, man, they're fixing this. They're fixing this baby for her to win. And they didn't do it. I don't know why, or maybe they just couldn't swing it enough. But I know that Roger Stone had people, boots on the ground in a lot of centers, watching them like a hawk. And there may have been people that said, hey, I'm not going to risk my life in jail to get Hillary Clinton elected, you know, for voter fraud. And so there is, I really don't know what happened. But with 12 to 17 million extra votes, she still could not win. So anyway, that's the January 19th paid cast. I highly suggest everybody listen to that. And that's the only place it's available is through the paid cast. So I really recommend that people join it. Okay, enough of that. Off on some other current topics and then to the main science topic. Oops, there is one topic I have here now. And then I'll put some information on the sales page also about this. If you have an order, this is for water filter products only. If you have an order of more than $3,500, and this is for, and this is a one-time thing. This is not a wholesale offer. If you have a greater than $3,500 order to put in for water filter products, I now have a special program where you can get. It's about between 17 and 22% off because the products vary depending on which products you buy. They have a different reduction percentage-wise, but the deductions are between 17 and 22%, somewhere in that range depending on the products. But if you have a group, say, and you want to buy water filters in through the group, if it's more than a $3,500 order, we will set it up where you will get that discount. And so at any rate, that's available. And the place to email is just email to the web address. It's jmcc@jmcanniescience.com. Just email to that address, and then we'll respond and take care of you, send you the information on how to do this. But serious inquiries only, and you have to have all the products shipped to a single location, only available in the United States. Hawaii and Alaska will have extra shipping. The shipping has gone up, and I should make this announcement too. For foreign shipping, the cost of foreign shipping has just skyrocketed. And so if you want products, water filter products in foreign countries, including Canada, or the Canada used to be almost like the United States to ship to, but Canada included has gone up quite a bit. Foreign countries have the price of shipping has just skyrocketed unbelievably. And so I just want to warn people, I still want you to order the products, but I want you to understand that we do charge shipping, and we only know what the shipping charges are going to be when we actually package everything up, weigh it and measure it and get it ready for shipping and get it processed. Only then do we know how much the shipping is going to cost, because sometimes it's multiple boxes. It's, you know, it's a complicated, too complicated a formula to do in advance. So we only know what shipping is going to cost for foreign orders. Domestic orders, all my shipping is included in the pricing for free. So you don't have to worry about this for the 48 states. But for Alaska, Hawaii, also shipping is extra because they charge a lot to ship it to those other two states. And people expect it there, but just warning people that there is that extra cost. The 48 states, there's no extra cost to shipping. It's free shipping to the 48 states for literally all the products. Okay, there might be a few where we charge a little bit for shipping to offset because they're inexpensive products. And remember that my 1 and 2 liter filters, personal filters, the prices have come down. They dropped like $20 off the price. So go check those out. They're on the webpage, jmccsci.com. So important announcements going into the future. And remember the bulk ordering $3,500, $3,500 or more, you can get from 17 to 22% off, depending on the products. And just email us at jmcc@jmccannyscience.com, and we'll take care of it. And by the way, don't forget my tanks, as long as I'm covering products. The tanks range from, what are they? I think the smallest one is like 125 gallons up to 20,000 gallons tanks. The big tanks, like 20,000 gallons, you have to order two at a time. And those have been going out. People are very happy with the products. We have 30 distribution centers in the United States and Canada, not available in Hawaii or Alaska or in foreign countries. But the 48 states and Canada, we have 30 distribution centers that they ship from. So those are also interactive. Go to the webpage, all the information there on how to purchase water tanks. And it's something that really, I think everybody should have, and have something in your house. If there's an emergency, believe me, you don't want to be filling your bathtub with water. And along with those tanks, you should probably buy a filter so that you're putting filtered water in the tank. And then you have a big supply. You can have 125 gallons or the totes. They're very nice. They're a cube, basically plastic tank in a cage, and they hold like 350 gallons, or what, 330 gallons, I'm sorry. So there's six 55-gallon drums, but in a cube that just sits in the corner. It's very economical space-wise, and they're very inexpensive, and we ship those all over the place. So anyway, check those out on the webpage. I think everybody should have a water tank. I do not like to make political commentary on this show, but I want to mention something. I talked about it before. The most dangerous situation in the world today is Iran gaining nuclear weapons and moving into a scenario where they have intercontinental ballistic missiles. Remember that the uranium that has been shipped to Iran recently from Russia came from the Clintons, from the Hillary Clinton and the State Department, where she took money in the Clinton Foundation and allowed money. This is from the Uranium One company, which is a Russian-owned company. They purchased Uranium One, which was a Canadian company, independent, a small company, a front company. And then that uranium, through a Clinton deal, pay-for-play, allowed Russia to take vast amounts of uranium from Canada. And that's what all of the Oregon hassle was about, and potentially also the Nevada issue, but more so the Oregon issue, where they were kicking those people off their ranches because that was part of a large uranium stake to do the same thing, to sell that uranium from Oregon to Russia. And so anyway, the uranium, which was yellow powder that needed processing, went to Russia, and then that same uranium, crude uranium, went to Iran through a deal that was cut through Obama, and they did make a nuclear deal, but much, much more uranium went to Iran than was allowed in the deal under Obama. So we are left with a terrible, terrible situation in the Mideast right now with Iran developing nuclear power, that nuclear potential weapons, because of the backdoor deals of Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. So it's very important to understand, when you see the issues going on with Iran right now, That is the core source of it. And I don't know why the news media doesn't talk about that. But since they're not, I'm talking about it on this show. And I only talk about things on this show relative to international, I don't know, if it's not really politics. It's international, that it has everything to do with science and engineering. Plus, remember that about 20 years ago, Iran, when it was in a more friendly state with the United States, trained the engineers that are now working there on these programs in United States University. And American kids, United States students, could not get into universities because of the large number of foreign students from Iran and India, etc. The same problem with India, Pakistan, etc. The scientists there who now have developed nuclear capabilities came to school in the United States. You paid for them with your money, and American students were not allowed into those schools because there wasn't enough room for them. That's what happened. And I was in these schools. I was in many school situations where I saw grad students from foreign countries that couldn't speak English trying to give undergraduate classes or problem session classes, etc. And the students couldn't understand them, yet they were there learning the technology of the United States to take it back to their country and develop it in use against the United States. I've never, ever understood this policy. It started in the after I got out of college, it was beginning. It got very bad into the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, etc. It got extremely bad, where American students could not get into American universities, private and public. Okay, on to the main science topic, oxygen on the moon. This is incredible. Study actually comes from 2008. Mind you, that's nearly 10 years ago. What do these scientists do sitting on this data? This I find probably more incredible than the story itself. The way they present it is that the moon, our moon, is robbing Earth's oxygen. And this came from a satellite, a Japanese satellite in 2008 that was measuring species, molecular species, and atomic species that were around the moon. And so anyway, they discovered that at a certain period of time, every month, there would be a blast of oxygen coming, and they really didn't know at the time where it came from. Now they've determined that it comes from Earth. And so it would be, if you're a regular scientist, it would be the only logical source of oxygen, because Earth has oxygen, but the upper atmosphere of Earth, it does not have very much oxygen at all. But anyway, since it's the only available source, that's what they conclude. But there's no direct evidence that it is coming from Earth. But let me explain, first of all, and also they talk about moon rocks. So I'll be talking about moon rocks also. But the oxygen issue, Earth is, now according to my plasma discharge comet model, the Earth is acting as a comet, as are all the planets, and anything down to the size of a grain of dust in the solar system are discharging the solar capacitor and in their local region. And so comets tend to discharge the capacitor more because they are coming in elliptical orbits and they're cutting the field lines, and therefore they cause more of a discharge than, say, planets that are in circular orbits that are at the same equipotential level gradient in the solar electric field, which is caused by an excess current of protons in the solar wind. And so that is all explained in my work. But what happens at the moon? Well, Earth is always pulling in oxygen and hydrogen and sulfur and all the other elements that are in our local region of the solar system. We're acting as a comet, plasma discharge comet. And so oxygen is just one of those species. But when the moon is out in the free solar wind, it is acting as a comet also. But it's a smaller comet, and since the Earth is dominating Earth actually has the bulk of the material coming into it, and what's a very small portion is left over for the moon, which is much smaller. So the moon has not been able to attract as much material because it is basically not discharging the solar capacitor as much as planet Earth, because we're bigger. That tends to be one of the factors. Okay, so Earth all the time has oxygen, hydrogen coming into it. So when the moon moves around into our, what traditionally is called the magnetic tail, it's really a comet tail in the truest sense of the word, because it's the Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. All that material is coming into Earth, and we are constantly gaining water. And that's why when Lou Frank did his experiment on the ultraviolet explorer, he was able to sneak a camera on there that measured water and saw blotches of water in the Earth's upper atmosphere. That's where it was coming from. And of course, standard science said, oh, that must be micro comets coming in, and the water then is apparent in, or seen in the upper atmosphere. But that explanation doesn't make any sense, because these are big, broad areas in the upper atmosphere where they observe the water, and not little pinpoint areas where micro comets would be coming in. And of course, they're not big comets. According to the ice ball comet model, they would be micro comets, so little teeny things that would come in, and really you wouldn't detect them. They wouldn't even be as big as a pixel on a regular detector. And so what's really going on is Earth, and I have pictures of this in my weather book where I have a picture, and it looks like the best common analogy you might consider is take a fish with a leech on it. A leech is a little blood-sucking kind of worm that attaches onto fish and then follows them around and attaches and basically lives mycorrhizal relationship with the fish, but it looks like it's attached to the fish, and then it comes off like a little streamer. And so that's what the comet tails look like when they're attached to Earth's upper atmosphere, and that brings in hydrogen and oxygen. And when they come in, they combine because of the electric field. They're coming in at a higher velocity than normal. They combine in to create water molecules, and they're observed in the Earth's upper atmosphere. So this is happening all the time with Earth. So when the moon comes around in our tail region for a few days every month, then the moon is in that region where there's already water, higher volumes of water than the moon normally receives. So the scientist's assumption that this oxygen is coming from Earth is incorrect. It's incorrect because they don't have any idea any other source of where oxygen could be coming from or anything else. So since oxygen happens to be one of the abundant forms of molecular species in our region of the solar system, around Jupiter, sulfur is very common. Jupiter region of the solar system, where the Jupiter orbit lies, is much more abundant in sulfur. That's why you have Io, very high sulfur content. Jupiter, that's where the red color of Jupiter comes from, is sulfur dioxide. When the 21 pieces of comet Schumacher-Levy 9 came into the atmosphere of Jupiter in 1995, I believe it was, they were water comets outside of the region of Jupiter, and as they came into the realm of Jupiter, they turned into sulfur dioxide comets, because that's the abundant species that was in that part of the solar system, and so they turned into sulfur dioxide comets. And so anyway, back to the moon. The moon then is passing through Earth's tail, picking up abundance of oxygen molecules that are coming in from the tail that the Earth already has. And so those, you cannot assume, there's possibly a bit of transport from Earth's atmosphere to the moon, but that's not the main source. The main source is because the moon is passing through Earth's comet tail. Now, a similar event happens when Earth passes through Venus' comet tail, And this happens every 584 days. Venus goes faster in its orbit than Earth, and it completes its year faster than Earth's orbit. So Earth, it completes an orbit, say that we have an alignment between Earth and Venus and the Sun, which we call inferior conjunction. That's the direct alignment of Earth, the visual direct alignment of Venus, the Sun, and Earth, Venus being between Earth and the Sun. And so Earth goes around in its orbit slower, and so Venus then catches up again, and so every 584 days, we have a what was called a synodic cycle. That's the cycle of Venus. In that time, the planet Venus has a tail, a comet tail, and it's producing viruses. And so that cycle of flu, what we call the flu, it's in China. This was noticed around 1200 AD. It's been published in medical journals. It's well recognized as a medical fact that there is an increase in the what is known as the bird flu. Now, the cycle is that the viruses are first affecting birds, then it goes to swine. That's where you hear the term swine flu, and then it's transferred to people. This, and it happens in China and in Russia, sometimes called the Russian flu. But really what it is, it's Venus, the inferior conjunction of Venus, and Earth passing through the tail of Venus and picking up these viruses, and everybody is sick. And so if you have, especially in areas where it's first dusty and then it rains, you get all of a sudden the people get sick. And it happens in a lot of, it's very common in third world countries. And I've identified this with the comet tail of Venus, and I've talked about this, I predicted it. And anyway, that's a whole nother issue. I talk about that on many other radio shows and in my work, in my printed work. But that's another example where Earth, in this case, comes into the comet tail of Venus, and we pick up, in this case, the viruses and a lot of other things too. But the viruses are the most noticeable because it makes you sick. And then that all clears out. The human body then adapts. And every year, every time the synodic cycle of Venus happens, every 584 days, we tend to get a different virus. So these are very complicated. They're very different. And basically, your body is set up to immunize yourself against these. And that's what the joke is about the flu shot, because you can't predict what the next synodic cycle is going to bring in terms of flu. And standard science claims that it's a variation of the previous flu. It has nothing to do with the previous flu at all. And so they're out there trying to create flu viruses for something that not anybody on planet Earth can predict. But your body is designed to identify those as a flu virus and then build that into your immune system. So, and this is done naturally. So it's best not to immunize anybody for flu, because your body, if your body is continually being protected, then it's going to become weaker and weaker and less well-equipped to fight off these viruses naturally. So anyway, the point is, that's another case where one celestial body comes into the tail of another and then picks up a surge of a biological species, in that case, the viruses, which are really very complex molecules, which are very complex structures of atoms and molecules hooked together. And in the case of the moon coming into Earth's tail, it's not a surprise that all of a sudden the Japanese satellite would pick up an excess of oxygen, which is the abundant species. Now, you can bet that in the case of Jupiter, as the moons of Jupiter move around Jupiter and they go into the tail region of Jupiter, that they're going to pick up sulfur. Not too hard to imagine that. And so it's amazing. And they probably do have a lot of data with the satellites, the Cassini mission around Saturn and the many satellites that have been around Jupiter, that there are similar data. But then again, nobody's going to publish it because nobody can figure out why that should be. Why should there be more on the tail side? And of course, what they would predict is that this is would be coming from Jupiter itself, which is not the case at all. This is material that's coming into Jupiter all the time. These planets, all of them are growing. They've discovered a slight atmosphere on the Mercury, on the planet Mercury. And that's due to the fact that it's drawing in material all the time, just like all the other planets. But the problem with Mercury, it's very close to the sun, so the solar wind is constantly blasting off and eroding anything that would accumulate around that planet. So at any rate, just giving you a little bit of sampling. Now, last week I talked about this so-called discovery by NASA, again, that the dust on the moon was electrified. And that if this is one of the fears when they so-called go back to the moon, one of the funny things that that the lunar dust is electrified. In other words, it's like static dust. And if you've ever lived in the wintertime up in a northern state when it's super dry, the dust becomes a problem because it floats around the room. And if you look at, say, the sun comes in the light in the morning, you see dust floating around the air and you go, where does this dust come from? Well, it's electrified dust, and it floats around the room. It actually levitates, so to speak, and it floats around the room, and you see it in the sunlight. And this does not typically happen in tropical places where you have humidity. This happens like lint-type dust that comes off of clothes and animal fur, etc., and it becomes electrified, and it levitates, and it floats around the room, and you can see it in the morning when the light sunlight comes in the window. And so anyway, that's what the lunar dust should be doing. And so if you have an astronaut that's bouncing around the moon and this dust cloud is coming up around their feet, they should be covered with lunar dust. And you see that if you look at the Apollo footage, the video of the astronauts, or even the still picture, they're standing there with dust all around and not a drop of dust on their spacesuits. They should be completely covered with dust, and their helmets and the glass or plastic, anything synthetic, which it's all synthetic, should be absolutely covered in massively covered with dust, and it's not. So therefore, that's another indication that all of that footage is faked. And so anyway, that's a whole nother issue, but that's one of the dangers of astronauts going to the moon, is because their spacesuits actually have to ventilate. When you breathe out, that air goes off into outer space, etc. So they have to have a certain amount of ventilation, and if those become clogged, then you got a problem. And more so, I mean, they could be their face mask could be covered with dust. They couldn't see well. Their cameras, their equipment would be completely covered with dust. So it really makes one wonder what's going on. Now, this brings up another topic in the same article where they talked about the oxygen molecules being discovered on the moon. They're talking about moon rocks. The moon rocks allegedly have a higher titanium content than rocks from Earth. And I've always maintained that the rocks that you would pick up on the moon and bring back for study have nothing to do with the moon. The moon has been bombarded. Just like Earth, you can look up in the sky and there's an estimate of how many tons of meteorites fall onto Earth every day. Tons and tons and tons of material falling in on Earth every single day. And this happening on the moon also. The outer space is simply filled with dust-sized particles up to small pebbles, zillions and uncountable numbers of these. And so they're constantly hitting the lunar surface. On Earth, they burn up in the Earth's atmosphere as they come in, and at nighttime, you can see these with good equipment. You can see the little ones that are coming in all the time. there are meteor streams that are results of comet tails, where the comets attract material with metals in them. The induced electric dipole force, as I explained in my plasma discharge comet model, that's why comets tend to have a stream of metal-rich, especially iron and nickel-rich metals in the tail material. And but any type of metal will work with the induced electric dipole force. What happens is you have a little grain of metal or lots of grains of metal in a meteorite or in a chunk of rock in outer space. The comet comes through. The comet is highly charged. The comet nucleus is negatively charged, so it repels the electrons, the free electrons in the piece of metal, the little grain of metal or whatever, and there's a lot of these in the piece of rock. A lot of rocks don't have any metal, so they're not susceptible to this effect because they're not conductors, but the metals are conductors, so the electrons go to the far side, leaving the close side positively charged, so that creates a slight attractive force, and that's what causes all of the meteorites that are metal-rich to be in the region of a comet tail. So if you could go out and mine that area around a comet, you would find a region which was metal-rich. Very interesting. Remember that my work also explains why the comets on the sunward side are diamond-rich. This is where, if you have a carbon-rich region of the solar system and a comet is passing through that, the electric field with the electron beam that is natural on the sunward side of the comet is a naturally occurring region for diamond production, and this has been duplicated in the laboratory. So once again, this is where the microdiamonds come from. When we have an event like the mastodons being killed, you see that they are just splattered with microdiamonds on the surface side, on the upper side, and not on the lower side. So that is one more indication that those events were caused by comets and the great flooding, the inundation that goes on, the flooding that goes on during the mass extinctions. So I have about a minute left in this show. Once again, I want to encourage you to sign up for the paid cast. The Cosmos series will be included starting tonight, the first episode of my Cosmos series, basically criticizing what Sagan did, what deGrasse Tyson did, and also the part included will be the new textbook study. And I encourage you to look at DVD number 1 and 2, the 1991 textbook study, where you'll see me as a much younger person, but still fighting the battle that I've been waging for decades, trying to get my message across that standard science is bogus and replacing it with my science. Once again, the webpage, go there. You can find all the links to sign up the new release on the Peru-Nazca lines will be there. And remember that if you have more than a $3,500 order for water filters, you can get a discount. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. The webpage, jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour. Good night.